of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, October 28th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Progressives up the ante on Medicare for All as the healthcare debate continues in Congress. Disney offers refunds for Baby Einstein videos, and Skin, an award-winning feature film based on the true story of a black woman born to white parents in apartheid South Africa.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. In a press conference on Monday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced proposed healthcare legislation that included a public option. Ending weeks of speculation, the Democrat from Nevada explained his decision this week by stating, quote, "I believe that a public option can achieve the goal of bringing meaningful reform to our broken system." Immediately after the announcement, political focus turned to whether or not Reid would be able to convince enough Democrats in the Senate to support the public option inclusive plan. Senator Mary Landrieu expressed skepticism, while her fellow Democratic colleague Ben Nelson would not indicate how he would vote on the Reid proposal. As a new NBC Wall Street Journal poll has shown increasing public support for the government-run option, its inclusion in Reid's legislation contains a provision aimed at political compromise. Hoping to gain support in the Senate, the plan holds that individual states can utilize an opt-out clause that would allow for the public option to be optional. Joining me in studio this morning to discuss how progressives have been responding to the healthcare debate on the ground, in the streets, and in the offices of insurance companies is Laura Flanagan. She is with the group Mobilization for Healthcare for All. Welcome to Uprising, Laura.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us today. So while all of this debate is happening in Congress, very little of it focused, if any, on getting government-run healthcare for everybody, so-called single-payer system or Medicare for All system. Much of it focused on whether or not to just have a government-funded option. All of this is happening in Congress and on the street, on the ground. People like yourself are risking arrest every single day in offices of insurance companies around the country. Explain, first of all, how this came about, where it started, and what you are planning on doing today.
Okay. Well, this started in September with a group of people who just decided we needed to have a discussion on Medicare for All and start showing that there is a very large group of citizens who are wanting this, and it's just been completely cut out of the discussion. So the first protest was held in New York on September 29th. And as part of our actions, we advocate for nonviolent civil disobedience. And it's just gotten to that point where we need to show that we're serious, and we will put our, you know, ourselves on the line, because this is how much we are dedicated to this becoming part of the discussion that there would be Medicare for All. And seeing people put themselves out there like that and risk arrest kind of opens up the debate of, wow, you're really serious about this, and that's so admirable, and it kind of gets the discussion speaking with maybe people in your life that you wouldn't otherwise. And it's just become a groundswell since then. After that, there was a protest in Chicago, and then the week after that, which was last Thursday, it was 9 cities, including Los Angeles, and here 12 of us were arrested for civil disobedience. And from there to this to today, we have 20 cities in the next few days who will be participating in protests at different health insurance companies.
So we talked a week and a half ago when that action was happening, the coordinated action in 9 cities, with LA being one of them. We spoke with Sam Pullen, in fact, by cell phone when he was just getting ready to commence with the sit-in at, I believe it was Blue Cross Anthem office.
Yes, it was.
And he did get arrested. He, in fact, has decided or had decided to stay in jail. Can you give us to continue protesting the lack of at least a public option option, if not Medicare for All. Can you give us any update on his status currently?
He has been released. He was in jail for 5 days, and he was willing to stay longer, but they threw his case out, so he was kind of kicked out of jail, if you will. Mm. And there was 12 of us. I was part of that.
So you also got arrested?
Yes, mm-hmm. I did.
How many days did you spend in jail?
I was released the same day. Okay. 11 of us were released the same day, and Sam Pullen was the only one who chose at the time to do jail no name, which is where you refuse to give your name mm-hmm. and stay. And we are hoping to get that to at a later date have a larger group of people do that together for jail solidarity and see if they can stay for a longer period of time until maybe we get something changed.
So when you say together for jail solidarity, explain that.
Doing jail no name so that you stay in there.
So you go, you're arrested and then you refuse to give your name.
Correct.
As part of your civil disobedience. And so they can't process you. Is that what it is?
Yes, it is. And mm-hmm. so you stay, and it really, as we saw with Sam, and that was only one person, it really gets the discussion out there. And so many people, just this outpouring of support and identifying with, you know, why he was doing it. And it really stepped up. We've had so many people who have since then decided to help us who were directly affected by how powerful his story was. And his mom had problems with the insurance company when she was sick. And that really was at a formative time in his life and kind of set the stage for his activism now. And, you know, everyone has a story where someone they know has been denied insurance or had insurance and thought it would cover them, and then it didn't. And it can be just such a devastating process when you need it the most, when you're sick, to have to be fighting the people who are supposed to be taking care of you.
My guest is Laura Flanagan. She is with the group Mobilization for Healthcare for All. Laura, you're going to be participating in an action in Glendale in just a couple of hours as part of this 20-city effort happening this week. Tell us about what's expected today, and can people join you, or is it too late perhaps?
anybody's welcome to join. It'll be 10 a.m. At the Cigna office on 400 North Brand in Glendale. We will have a legal protest on the sidewalk, which anybody is welcome to come support and join in. And then there are people who are willing to risk arrest who will be doing a sit-in, waiting, hoping to have someone from Cigna come down and actually have a discussion with us.
So you basically will show up to the office, the Cigna office at 400 North Brand in Glendale today, not too far from the KPFK studios, at 10 a.m. And then those of you willing to risk arrest, I'm assuming that includes you today, or?
No, I'm still waiting for my court date for the last one, so I cannot at this
so
moment.
So there are others who are going to risk arrest. They're going to go and sit in the Cigna office and refuse to move till a Cigna representative comes down and talks to them about why they're ripping people off?
Well, yes. Our demand is that they will, on air or to the public, say that they will stop spending money on lobbyists lobbying against healthcare reform and use that money for their patients who are being denied treatment, that doctor recommended treatment that would save their lives, and to use their money where it should be focused.
So that's a very specific demand to the health insurance companies. Now, on a broader on the broader front of the battle over healthcare reform, what specifically is Mobilization for Healthcare for All calling for? Because there's so many sort of variations of what healthcare people can, you know, want to demand.
Yes, there is. We are advocating for Medicare for All, a single payer plan that would cover everybody.
So that is the basic ultimate thing that you want.
Yes.
And that's the minimum that you're fighting for.
Yes. We are the only industrialized democracy who does not have universal health care. And it's just sad that in this country we would
But
let
universal
our people...
government funded health care.
Yes.
Those are two different things, because you can certainly have universal health care.
Government
right.
funded. Yes.
And in fact, Congress does want to make health care universal, but that would be health insurance system universal. And they're talking, of course, about this mandate to force everybody to buy insurance and then subsidize the poorest as a sort of a wonderful new pool of millions of forced customers for the insurance companies.
Sure. And as we see now, they're not giving the proper care to the customers they have. So this is just giving them more money and more customers to then deny. And it's not a working system. And so we knew we need to have a system that is government-run, that is not for-profit, so that the money is going to who it should be going to.
Laura, where did the sort of who are the people in Mobilization for Healthcare for All? It seems to me to be in your group that has formed after the summer. During the summer, the news media were obsessed with covering the healthcare forums of members of Congress that were inundated by very raucous groups of conservatives and right-wing folks mobilized by, you know, the various groups, even some of them front groups for insurance companies, who would shout down any kind of support for government-funded healthcare. And Mobilization for Healthcare for All, I understand, came after that, right?
It did. And it started with it still is the core people, a very small group, who have been activists for a while, but have now decided to really focus their attention and energies on healthcare. And it kind of comes because of seeing things where people are being disrespectful and stopping the debate and not really trying to up the discourse and really get to the meat of things and discuss it, but to just shut down the debate at all. And at some point scaring people from even speaking their mind. And we advocate very heavily for nonviolent activism and civil disobedience. And so, you know, we're advocating for Medicare for everyone, even the people screaming back against it. You know, we want them to be covered and healthy as well. And so we saw that and decided there needs to be a very respectful, open dialogue about this. And that's kind of where it came out of. And like with myself, I only found out about the last protest a few days before, joined in, and now I'm the LA coordinator, and that's kind of how this movement is starting. One of our national coordinators, it was her first time doing civil disobedience with us as well, and now she's working on this on a national level, and there's just so many people who may never have thought of protesting or doing something like civil disobedience before, but, you know, healthcare is something that all of us need, and it affects all of us, and it's kind of bringing more people out of the woodwork who are stepping up and saying, this is what we need, and I'm going to state that.
Were you an activist before you joined this?
On a very low, you know, low-key level. I've been to protests and rallies before and done campaigning, but I've never organized. I've never been at a high level of organizing. I've certainly never contemplated civil disobedience before.
So it was your first time getting arrested last time?
It was, for anything, yes.
What was that experience like? Was it empowering or frightening?
Both, but empowering by far was the emotion that I felt more. When you're sitting at the sit-in, just seeing around everybody else who's committed and their strength, kind of you feed off that. And it was frightening at certain points, but overall it was a very rewarding situation, and it kind of solidified my desire to keep acting towards Medicare for All.
I'm speaking with Laura Flanagan. She's with the group Mobilization for Healthcare for All. And she, along with many others, are going to be at the Cigna office today at 10 a.m. in just a couple of hours at 400 North Brand Boulevard in Glendale. There's going to be a legal protest on the sidewalk that anybody can join in. And then a smaller group will be doing a sit-in inside the offices, risking arrest. Laura, let's talk about tactics. So you mentioned the issue of people shouting others down and stopping the debate during the summer. This was a very sort of interesting playbook that people were playing by. These are the sort of conservatives who were clearly against any government-funded option. In fact, I think what I got was, you know, when you pull aside the "we all hate Obama" rhetoric, it was a sort of "we don't want government in anything." And of course, there were even people shouting, "Get the government out of my Medicare," which reveals so much ignorance. But then there was this sense that they were going to show up and shout people down and shut everything down and shut down all the debate, and that would have been considered success. In terms of that tactic, though, would you say that they were successful? You know. And what did those tactics reveal about the conservatives versus the tactics that you are using?
No, I wouldn't say it's successful. I think in a short term it was. It received a lot of media exposure, and that gets their point out there. But then that also shows that they don't have a point. And I think most people don't respond well to angry and to violent. That's not something that you want directed at you. So after the initial, "Oh, wow, isn't this fun to ogle at?" you start thinking about it. And there again, it became so apparent that they didn't have something that they were advocating for, just against. And so, no, I don't think it worked very well. And then, as I said before, you know, we're advocating for Medicare for all, for everyone. And so we are very respectful to anyone who wants to have a dialogue with us. If there's protesters, we don't heckle back. You know, we'll just try to engage them in a meaningful conversation politely and respectfully. And I think that will win more people over as they say that, well, this is something that I can get behind, that, you know, they're not trying to intimidate or anything of that nature.
And those who want to join these actions but don't want to risk arrest, you know, people who might be in a different situation, either legally or just for health purposes or just, you know, for choice, how can they join in with these actions?
Well, there's plenty of ways to. If you go to mobilizeforhealthcare.org, you can sign up. And this is, again, a national movement, so they will direct your email to your contact information to the correct state and then city level. And we need people to reach out to the media, to reach out to their fellow citizens, to help coordinate behind the scenes, just to mobilize our effort in so many different ways. And a lot of people I've also found who would never have considered civil disobedience, once they start joining in and speaking more with other people, they start to have a different feel for what that means and what it can do. And a lot of people, like myself included, will change their mind. We aren't pushy about it. We would never try to force someone into doing it. But I think it's something that people may think they would never consider. Mm-hmm. And then once they start joining in other ways, we'll realize they might.
The website is mobilizeforhealthcare.org. And after this week's set of events, is there anything on the horizon, or are discussions still in works?
There is. This is going to keep going. Going to keep going. And it's escalating in waves where, as I said, we have a protest today, tomorrow, Thursday or Friday, some next week. We are already planning another one in Los Angeles for mid-November. Again, as the debate changes in Congress, then it will possibly change. We may direct our attentions not so much to health insurance sitting in offices, maybe it'll be towards representatives. There's, you know, it's a fluid movement at this point, depending on how the discussion goes.
Laura Flanagan, best of luck to you today, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Laura Flanagan is with the group Mobilization for Healthcare for All. Again, mobilizeforhealthcare.org is the website, and the event is happening today, 10 a.m. at 400 North Brand Avenue. That's the Cigna offices in Glendale. You're listening to Uprising, and later in the hour, we will speak with the award-winning film composer for the film Skin to hear about what this film means. It's opening in theaters this Friday. We'll also, after today's Subversive Historian and this week's Who Said That contest, talk about why the Disney company is offering refunds for its Baby Einstein videos. Stay tuned.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day, on October 28th, 1959, Cuban revolutionary Camilo Cienfuegos mysteriously died. The long-bearded swashbuckler boarded an airplane 50 years ago, flying to Havana, when it disappeared over the ocean at night. The Cuban government immediately organized a massive search lasting days, but could not recover debris from the crash nor locate the body of the immensely popular icon of the revolution. Born to a Spanish anarchist family in 1932, Cienfuegos became politicized in the student movements against Cuban dictator Fulgencio Batista. He then moved to Mexico, where he met up with Fidel Castro's grandma expedition. Cienfuegos would go on to become a comandante in the course of the revolution. Controversies exist over the nature of Cienfuegos' political orientation and to his death, but what remains certain is that many Cubans revere him as a hero and mark the occasion of his passing by floating flowers into the ocean. For Uprising, this is your Truth Professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
No more lies.
And now we come to the special feature of our program.
Who said that? Who said that?
Who is it?
You got to tell me who.
So what do you call yourself? Huh? Como se llama?
I can't hear you.
What's your name, dude?
Who the hell are you?
I really want to know.
If it's anybody, it's me.
Who? So,
who is this?
Come on! Come on!
Seems as though I've heard that before.
Before we go to our next story, it's time now for this week's edition of Who Said That? It's a weekly contest in collaboration with the Pacifica Radio Archives. Here's how it goes. We play you a short soundbite from the archives' vault and ask you to tell us who said that. To win the CD we're featuring, just call in and identify the voice. Let's take a listen to this week's mystery speaker.
The one question people ask me the morning thing is, they say, how do you do it? Don't you get discouraged? They say, don't you get fed up? I get tons of mail, and 10% of my mail is questioning, how do you stay with it? Very simple. Just stay with it.
And if you know who that is, and if you haven't won yet, call us right now at 818-985-5735 with your best guess. That's 818-985-KPFK. If you're the first person to call in and guess the correct answer, we'll send you the CD that we just featured. When the Disney company made claims years ago that its line of Baby Einstein videos might make infants and toddlers smarter, parents lined up to buy them. The marketing of the DVDs implied that they were educational, despite no evidence to support it. In fact, today, pediatricians recommend absolutely no television for children under the age of two. In 2006, a group of consumer advocates called the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood brought a Federal Trade Commission complaint against the company, which forced Baby Einstein to stop claiming that the videos were educational. But the campaign went further and succeeded in pressuring the company to offer refunds to anyone who bought the videos. A spokesperson for Baby Einstein has responded to the campaign as, quote, a sensational headline-grabbing publicity campaign that seeks to twist and spin a simple customer satisfaction action into a false admission of guilt. The news of Baby Einstein refunds come at a time when a new Nielsen survey of TV watching habits in the U.S. reveals that children aged 2 to 5 spend on average 32 hours a week in front of the screen, and that for children of all ages, TV watching is at an 8-year high. My guest is Josh Golan. He's Associate Director of Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood. Welcome to Uprising, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, can you tell us exactly what the Baby Einstein videos claimed? And after your complaint was successful with the Federal Trade Commission, how did they change their actions?
Well, sure. I mean, it's important to understand that from day one, Baby Einstein was making some really overt educational claims about their videos. For instance, their first video that they released back in 1998 was accompanied by a press release that said, this developmental video combines visual and linguistic experience that facilitate the development of the brain in infants from ages 1 to 12 months. I mean, imagine that. For a one-month-old baby, they're making these claims.
So facilitate the development, that's the language.
Yes, the development of the brain in infants ages 1 to 12 months. And they continued to make claims like this over the years, you know, saying things like it would help with learning numbers, helping with brain development, helping with cognitive development. And so after our Federal Trade Commission complaint, they stopped making these kind of overt educational claims about their videos. But, they've really had already built up the brand based on this idea that this is what these videos were going to do for babies.
Not to mention, just the name Baby Einstein says it all. You don't really even have to make those claims if you're calling, you know, if the company's called Baby Einstein.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the name certainly implies that. In fact, Baby Einstein sent out a email message yesterday to everybody on their email list in which they said, you know, we're not implying that we're educational. We don't have the word genius in our name.
And they do.
They don't have the word genius, but they have the word Einstein, and that's pretty much a synonym in our culture.
So, when they made those claims initially, did they ever try to have any kind of research backing it up, or even point to even industry-funded research?
No, they did not. They never released any research that supported any of these claims. And, you know, at the same time, there was independent studies coming out that were starting to question whether videos for infants had any kind of educational benefit.
Now, is there any research that shows that videos at an early age before two are actually detrimental to the development of the brain? I mean, why do pediatricians say no television for children before the age of two?
Well, they say that for a couple of reasons. One, because there's not a lot of research out there. But what there is cause for concern. For instance, one study showed that babies who were watching these videos had slower rates of language development. And obviously, that's something to be concerned about. But we do need more research to, before we can conclusively conclude that there's harm or there isn't harm. But in the light of, you know, having enough research, it's best to be cautionary, and particularly because what we do know is that babies who watch more of these videos do less of the things that we know are good for development. That's interacting with parents, that's engaging in play, and exploring the world around them instead of exploring a world on the screen.
And these videos have often been called digital babysitters at a time when parents are so overworked and overwhelmed with so many responsibilities and under so many stresses. It's not terribly surprising and perhaps forgivable that parents might have bought these videos and sat their children in front of them. I'm wondering if you've heard of the anecdotes that I was reading about of some parents' experiences with these videos, who would find that their children were a lot more dazed, slower acting, you know, behaving in this sort of dazed fashion after, for an hour or so after watching these videos.
Yeah, no, we've heard that from a lot of parents that, you know, they watch these videos and their babies kind of go into a trance-like state. And that's, you know, that's something certainly that's concerning for those parents. And it absolutely is understandable why parents would use these things, given their busy schedules. But you know, the research has shown that the number one reason that parents give for allowing their parents to their babies to watch screen media is because they believe it's good for cognitive development. And so, you know, what we want is for parents to have honest information. So when they make that big decision about whether I want my baby to watch television or not, or when do I want them to start watching television, they're doing it based on real research and real information. And they're not, you know, I think that's probably what they want to hear, that it's good for brain development. But they should know the truth before they make these hard decisions.
Is there any research showing that watching television is ever good for anybody's brain development, infant, or, you know, child or adult?
We know there are studies that certain programs are good at teaching children various concepts. You know, Sesame Street has been shown for children over 2.5, you know, to be good at teaching things like math and vocabulary and things like that. But, you know, anything that children can learn from television, they can also learn from other things as well.
Well, what's the difference between Sesame Street and Baby Einstein? And what specifically was the complaint of your organization? Was it just that it was for kids under the age of 2 and that you're okay with these videos being shown for kids 2 and up?
Well, our concern was that there was no, you know, that they were making claims that weren't supported by research. I mean, there has been extensive research done on Sesame Street. Sesame Street's probably the most researched program in the history of television. And there is research that, you know, the things that that Sesame Workshop claims about Sesame Workshop are in fact supported by research. But there is absolutely no evidence that any program, including Sesame's own line of videos for babies, Sesame Beginnings, are beneficial for children under 2.
My guest is Josh Golan, Associate Director of Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. Now, the name of your campaign suggests that you certainly don't want or you think that it's not good for kids to be exposed to commercials. But how, in what way was Baby Einstein, I know that you said that the main issue was the claims they were making, but were Baby Einstein videos, and I have to say I really haven't watched one, so I really don't know, but do they expose kids to any kind of commercial advertising or, you know, start branding their characters with kids at an early age?
Well, that's a great question. And we were concerned about Baby Einstein in terms of our larger mission for a couple of reasons. One, in fact, it is a brand that is promoted to children. And, you know, there are actually Baby Einstein toys are in the Baby Einstein videos, and so the videos are promoting these toys.
So it's a sort of different. It's the same kind of marketing that you see with films for kids, where once you get the kids to watch the films, then they can get the little characters at the McDonald's and you know, buy all of these various things associated with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are no McDonald's tie-ins, but there are. there are, in fact, a whole line of Baby Einstein toys, many of which appear in these films, and so there is branding in that way. And there's also branding in the fact that Disney has launched a Little Einsteins line, too, complete with whole lines of toys and videos and food products. And so Baby Einstein, you know, the Einstein brand now extends into preschool, and so, you know, the idea is to get kids watching when they're babies, and then, you know, continue to have them attached to this brand as they move into their preschool years. So that's, I mean, that type of branding is one reason why we're really concerned about Baby Einstein. But another reason why we're really concerned is because, you know, the push to get children in front of screens at an earlier and earlier age, that's how children are marketed to. And so we know that children who watch these videos are watching more television at later ages. And really, you know, the push to get kids in front of screens, whether it's computer screens, whether it's television screens, it's really a push to expose them to marketing.
Hmm. So in terms of the refund now that Disney Company, which is the parent company of Baby Einstein, is offering for these DVDs, it's not exactly a recall, right? I mean, it's a refund. And how does that work if my listeners now want to get refunds for their Baby Einstein DVDs? What can they do?
Well, it's a refund for up to four DVDs that they've purchased in the last 5 years. They can go to the Baby Einstein website, or they can go to our website, and there are links that will explain exactly what they need to do. But you don't need a proof of purchase. You just need the DVD, and you can mail it back to Baby Einstein, and then you'll get a refund for $16 per DVD that you return.
Cash refund?
Yes.
Hmm.
Yes.
And your organization, again, Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, the website is commercialexploitation.org. And so listeners can use that as a path to figure out how to get their refunds, commercialexploitation.org. Now, will Baby Einstein actually stop producing these DVDs?
No, Baby Einstein is going to continue producing the DVDs, but we think that you know, that there's been a real turning point this last week, and all of the media coverage surrounding this refund and all of the discussion going on in parenting blogs and listservs and things like that is really going to change the way that people look at these videos. And at the very least, parents aren't going to feel like, if I don't get a Baby Einstein video, my child is going to fall behind.
And there's so much pressure on parents to sort of buy into this sort of thing. So many companies that offer these gizmos and gadgets to supposedly make your children smarter, but what most pediatricians, I think, would tell you is that, and I think you mentioned this earlier, is that simple parent interaction, the more parent interaction there is with children, the more their brains develop. And so much of this also has to do with how children are raised, whether to be passive members of a society, you know, watching television and absorbing all the marketing, or to be active civic members, you know, engaged in society. I mean, you can sort of trace that back to childhood, right?
Absolutely, and what you just said is absolutely at the core of what we're trying to do. You know, there's such a difference between being a good consumer and being a good citizen. And advertising is based on the idea that we're, you know, supposed to buy things based on impulses and appealing to our emotions and desires to be cool and fitting in and things like that. And it's the antithesis of the critical thinking skills that we really need to develop in children if we want to revive our democracy and thrive in future generations.
Very briefly, Josh, let's talk about the Little Einstein line of marketing, and of the videos and other related items and products that Baby Einstein's parent company, that the whole company, Disney's companies, are also marketing to young children. Is this something that you see preschools and kindergarten and other schools trying to adopt into their own coursework? And if so, is this something that your organization is going to go after?
It is something that you see increasingly being incorporated into coursework. All of the major media companies, it's certainly not just Disney, but, you know, Nickelodeon and all the major media companies for kids have preschool curriculums that are distributed in preschools, and also tons of materials for teachers to download off of their websites. And teachers, understandably, you know, particularly new teachers who are struggling to engage children. You know, if you use a character like Dora the Explorer or SpongeBob, it might be easier to get a child's attention, and they may not necessarily think about the fact that they're promoting brands to their children. And so, yes, that's absolutely something that we work on and try and raise awareness. And we do all sorts of advocacy trying to get advertising out of schools because we think that that's some of the most insidious stuff that goes on, because this is a place where children don't even have the option of opting out.
Well, Josh Golan, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Josh Golan is Associate Director of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. Thanks, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
And again, the website for the organization where you can find out more about the refunds for up to 4 Baby Einstein DVDs, $16 a DVD, and you don't need a receipt. That website is commercialexploitation.org, or you can also just Google Baby Einstein and find their website and do it through them. And there is a deadline, I believe, for how long that refund is available. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we'll bring you the answer of this week's Who Said That contest, and then we'll hear about this new award-winning film opening in theaters, select theaters, this Friday. It's called simply Skin. Stay tuned.
Dissident member of the Afghan parliament and the woman the BBC calls the most famous woman in Afghanistan, Malalai Joya, has written a new political memoir about her life and the story of her devastated nation, called A Woman Among Warlords. Malalai Joya survived 4 assassination attempts, is an outspoken voice against the U.S. occupation of her country, and one of the few Afghans who dares to risk her life to be the voice of her people. All Saints Church in Pasadena presents a talk by Malalai Joya on Friday, November 6th at 7 p.m. at 132 North Euclid Avenue. Copies of her book will be available for purchase. Uprising host Sonali Kahatkar, a close personal friend of Ms. Joya, will introduce her. Again, that's Friday, November 6th at 7 p.m. at All Saints Church, 132 North Euclid Avenue in Pasadena. More information is available by calling 626-583-2734 or go to kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. Before we go to our final story, the winner of this week's Who Said That contest is Tony Taylor. Congratulations, Tony, for guessing the correct answer, which is Cesar Chavez. Cesar Chavez was a Mexican-American labor activist and leader of the United Farm Workers. He was a leading voice for migrant farm workers and helped organize successful boycotts against major grape growers. The late Senator Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, hailed Chavez as one of the heroic figures of our time. He died on April the 23rd, 1993. We'll send a copy of the CD featuring Cesar Chavez to our winner, Tony Taylor. Let's take another listen to the clip we played earlier.
The one question people ask me, the morning thing, as they say, how do you do it? Don't you get discouraged? They say, don't you get fed up? I get tons of mail, and 10% of my mail is questioning, how do you stay with it? Very simple. Just stay with it.
That is, of course, the voice of Cesar Chavez. For those of you who didn't win, you can order the CD featuring this clip from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And you can try your luck again next week on Wednesday. The multiple award-winning independent feature film Skin, directed by Anthony Fabian, tells the real-life story of Sandra Lang, a South African woman with dark skin and black curly hair, born to white Afrikaner parents in apartheid South Africa, parents who are unaware of their own black ancestry. Skin is a reflection on the devastation of institutional racism exemplified by South African apartheid and exacerbated by existing patriarchal structures. Despite her appearance, Sandra Lang was raised by her parents as a white girl. Her father fought the court system to classify her as white and even sent her to a white school from which she was expelled. Eventually, at age 17, she chose to leave white society and follow her heart, living as a black woman for the first time in her life. For black South Africans, life in the Bantustans of South Africa was quite different and much harder than Sandra's childhood. While the film explores a number of intersecting issues of race, gender, class and politics, at its heart it's also about the complex relationship between Sandra and her parents. Skin opens in select theaters this Friday, and my guest this morning is Elaine Muddyman. She is the award-winning film composer for Skin. Welcome to Uprising, Elaine.
Thank you very much, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us today. You are the composer of the film, but you're also very familiar with the film and have been very close to the creation of this film. This is a true story that the film was based on. Sandra Lang still lives, and she's somebody who is played by an actor in this film. Why is this story so important and so powerful to tell?
I think for many reasons. I mean, it certainly has changed my life. I never thought of myself as at all racist until I saw this film, and it made me realize that passive racism is just as awful as positive racism, and you can not engage with people because you don't feel you relate to them. And I think this film really gets to the heart of people and the way they look at other people and their sense of belonging and how we judge others. And I think that's what's so clever about this film is it doesn't preach, it doesn't try to criticize. It just shows an example of how a family have coped in a system that was so extreme. And the relationship between the parents, and there's just so much in this film that is so important that I think that's the reason we're so passionate about it.
Let's take a listen to an excerpt of the film Skin. This is a scene from the courtroom where Sandra Lang's father is struggling to get his daughter classified as white.
Are you prepared to swear before God and on the Bible that you are the parents of this child?
I am, my lord. I mean, we are, my lord.
Thank you. Call in the next witness, please. Dr. Sparks, I believe you have a statement to make.
I've studied the Lang's case closely.
I'm a great admirer of brevity, Dr. Sparks, but will you please give us your area of expertise and a place of work?
Sorry, Genetics research fellow at Wits University.
Thank you.
I believe there's a plausible genetic explanation for Sandra's appearance. The history of our country is such that many, indeed, we believe most Afrikaners carry black genes.
Silence. Please go on.
So two white-looking parents can contribute enough black genes to produce a child quite a lot darker than themselves. And this phenomenon is commonly known as a throwback. We prefer to use the more precise term, polygenic inheritance.
Thank you, Doctor.
That's an excerpt from the film Skin, which is opening in two theaters locally here this Friday, the Landmark Theater in West Los Angeles, the Lumley Town and Country Cinemas in Encino. And then on November 6th, it's also opening at the Pasadena Lumley Playhouse 7 in Santa Ana, at the Regency South Coast Village Cinemas, and in Palm Springs at the Camelot Theater, also in La Jolla at the La Jolla Village Cinemas. And you can find out all about the film as well as where it's screening. And if you can find it at a theater near you, at the website skinthemovie.net. That's skinthemovie.net. My guest is Elaine Muddyman. She is the award-winning film composer for Skin. Now, this clip that we just heard, Elaine, was a very, very interesting clip. Can you tell us a little bit about the sort of legal dilemma that Sandra Lang, the main character in this film, finds herself in, and how race was classified in apartheid South Africa?
At that time, the blacks and the whites weren't allowed to live together. And so the dilemma was whether she was, if she was going to be considered black, was she allowed to live with her parents? It was an extraordinary situation. So when she went to school, people did protest that she was black and she shouldn't be in a white school. And indeed, the the school had her reclassified as coloured. And this set up so many issues that she wasn't allowed to go to a white school. She wasn't actually classified black, but she was classified coloured. So the parents...
And for those who are not aware of those various sort of racial classifications, the term coloured meant sort of mixed heritage.
Yes.
Or means mixed heritage in South Africa.
And it certainly meant that she couldn't partake in the privilege of that white society had at that time in that place. It was a major issue for her, obviously, in her education. She wasn't allowed to go to the school that her brother went to before her.
And her brother looked white, her older brother.
He looked more white mm-hmm. than she did. There was definitely issues when he went to school. But when she came along, those issues were too hard to sweep under the carpet. And she was, people protested that she was not white enough. It was a terrible situation for the parents who obviously wanted the best for their child, but yet they couldn't quite see the wood for the trees. They couldn't understand that the system was what was wrong. It wasn't trying to get her into the system, but actually if they had tried to fight the system and get it changed, that would have been much better. But of course at the time they were so indoctrinized in this apartheid system that they tried to get her into it rather than try to change the system.
And the film shows the struggles as a backdrop, the struggles against apartheid as a backdrop. I mean, most people are so well aware now of the very long struggle against apartheid in South Africa. But Sandra Lang's life sort of went on. She made her own personal choices because she was sort of forced to at age 17 as a young black girl who was trying to figure out why her parents wanted to keep her away from the black man she fell in love with. So she chose this life that was, of course, much, much more difficult. But at the same time, she was happier being in a place that accepted her as one of them. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of transition in her life that's also shown in the film and how that was portrayed in the film even?
Yeah, she fell in love with a black man, and obviously her parents, being so institutionalized in their racism, were not approving of this. And I think this is a common issue with parents generally, that, you know, parents and children often disagree with choices that each other make. So I think that's quite an important part of the film that helps us to understand how we feel about the relationships we have with our parents. In her case in particular, the black community, she definitely felt much more at home in, and she felt much more accepted, although, you know, still she didn't feel she really belonged in either situation. So it was definitely that she felt more understanding from them, though. And in particular, her husband's mother was her surrogate mother in many respects, and she still keeps in touch with her. And in fact, while she's over here, she's in America at the moment. She's in New York now. But while she's here, her mother-in-law is staying at her house with her new husband. Well, I say new. They've been together 20 years.
With the second husband.
Yes, with the second husband.
But you bring up the issue of husband. Even the person that is portrayed in the film, Skin, as this man, Petraeus, that she falls in...
Petrus.
That she falls in love with. They weren't able to really get officially married till she could sort of reclassify her own race, in such a bizarre thing to think about. I mean, even with the horrible legacy of slavery and racism in the United States here, the sort of classification by race is an interesting thing to think of in South Africa.
I think it's what's frightening as well is to imagine how recent it is.
Right. It was just, 20, 30 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, 1994 was when the apartheid ended. So I think that's what's so frightening, to imagine it's within our lifetime.
So where is Sandra Lang today? And, you know, what was the process of making the film? And how did you and the filmmakers, you know, create this film based on the life of somebody who's, you know, still living? Was she part of an intimate part of the process?
Yes. I mean, Anthony Fabian, the director, he was sitting in his kitchen one day and he heard the story on the radio, and he was so moved by it that he went to South Africa to meet with Sandra Lang and asked her if she would trust him with telling her story. And the first thing he did was have a book written about her, which he could then use all the interviews from the book, which is called When She Was White, use all the text from that book and use that to help write the script. And 5 script writers were involved in writing the script for the film. And it's taken 9 years for us to get to this point for various reasons. I mean, most of it to do with getting the script perfect, because obviously that was a major part of the film. We felt it, without the script being fantastic, it had to be a good grounding for us to build the film around. Mm. The last 2 years we've actually spent also trying to get the film distributed, because we've come up against a lot of problems with people worried about the issues that are being raised in this film, and it's a bit like the elephant in the room. People are frightened to have these points brought to the public's notice for fear of, there being an uprising, I guess, of people conscious of the issues that it raises in this film.
Let's take another listen to a clip from the film Skin. This excerpt is conversation between Sandra Lang, the main character in the film. This is, of course, based on a true story, and her father. And it's about an issue that's commonly discussed at the dinner table when teenagers are involved. It's about dating, except in this film, of course, it takes on a whole new dimension.
So that's two she's decided aren't good enough for her.
Barbara, leave her alone.
Do you love me?
That's a stupid question.
Look at me. What do you see?
I see my beautiful girl.
Pa, I'm not white. That's what those boys want, a white girl to marry, to have children with.
That's enough. Whiskey's from the table. Go. Go.
And that is another excerpt from the film Skin, which is opening at theaters, select theaters, this weekend, this Friday, in fact. You can catch it at the Lemley Theater in Encino, as well as at the Landmark in West Los Angeles. And in fact, we have 3 pairs of passes to the Encino Lemley screening, any screening of your choice, after Monday, next Monday and after, to Skin. If you call us right now at 818-985-5735, we'd love to give you a pair of tickets, a pair of passes to see Skin at the Encino Lemley. And if you can't make it to the theater, we also have a couple of copies of the soundtrack, a fabulous award-winning soundtrack that my guest Elaine Muddyman is responsible for, and she has very generously donated a couple of CDs of the soundtrack to the film Skin. Your choice. You call 818-985-5735. Let us know if you want the passes or the CD. And we will certainly try to hook you up. And it looks like the phone lines have already filled up. Elaine, let's talk a little bit about the, what you think you want people to take away from this film. Obviously, it's been a long battle for yourself and the filmmakers to get this film together and then to even get it distributed. And I mean, just looking at the number of awards it's won a lot of awards. Yeah. Against all of these odds, what do you hope that people take from this film? Even people who aren't really necessarily, involved in or familiar with what happened in South Africa.
Well, I think for a start, it's a nice way to be educated about something that we perhaps don't know very much about in South Africa. But also, it really does help people, I think, to come to terms with some of their own feelings of either feeling outcast from a society or actually persecuting other people for what they see to be different. Just for example, with myself, I suddenly realized that, when I drop my children off at school and I'm in the playground, in the schoolyard, sometimes I realized I don't make eye contact with people that I perhaps don't relate to. And I realized that actually that's not a good way to be. And even if I don't think I have something in common with someone, it doesn't necessarily mean to say that we can't reach out. So I think things like that, very subtle things that I hope people will see this very quiet, very strong hero of the film and think to themselves, gosh, that's an amazing feat of strength that this woman has endured all this racism throughout her life. And, maybe there are some ways that we impact other people's lives in a much, much less strong way. But at the same time, maybe we could you know, cut people some slack in many respects and reach out. And I think that's what we're hoping is that humanity, I mean, we've won the Amnesty International Humanitarian Award and the Time for Peace Award, because I think these organizations, United Nations ambassadors who gave these awards, they understand that there is something very poignant in the film that can help people understand.
And the film has shown in South Africa?
It has, but we don't open there properly until January.
It won an award there as well.
I'm losing count of where we've lost where we've won awards. To be
honest. Remember seeing one on your website from a South African festival. Right. So, and what has the response been like in South Africa?
Oh, it's been really positive, really positive. In fact, you know, South Africa generally, Alice Krieg, who was here on your show last week, was saying
on our station.
Yes, on your station, she was saying how amazing it is that, you know, especially the blacks in South Africa really are forgiving, and this truth and reconciliation is, you know, it's amazing how forgiving they are of what happened in South Africa. And the film, I think they, you know, the whites and the blacks in South Africa embrace this film because it doesn't point the finger at anybody in particular, and it just tells the story as to what happened.
Well, it's very clear when you watch the film whose side you want to be on, but at the same time, you're right, a lot of the characters who do act in certain ways because they've bought into this system, this very cruel and evil system, are I suppose at most guilty of accepting the status quo.
Yeah.
And the father, as well as the first husband of Sandra Lang, these two men also, you know, I think bring up these very interesting intersections between race and gender, which we haven't had time to get into today. But Elaine, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're actually going to listen to one of the tracks from your award-winning soundtrack, Let Freedom Reign, as we wrap up the show. My guest has been Elaine Muddyman. She's the award-winning composer, film composer for Skin. Thanks so much, Elaine.
Thank you.
And congratulations to everybody who won tickets as well as CDs. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Nelson Mandela once said, "For to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others." That's Nelson Mandela, and that's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You can find out more about the film Skin at skinthemovie.com. That's skinthemovie.net. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer, Chris Bennett is our intern, and Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this show after 10 a.m. today on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8.